The headlines: people in London rally to voice support for Palestinians one day before the anniversary of Nakba Day or the Palestinian catastrophe. The Russian President Vladimir Putin says it will be a mistake for Finland to abandon its neutral status by joining the U.S.-led NATO military alliance. Plus, a member of Northern Ireland's Sinn Féin says the country is working or walking an irreversible journey towards reunification with the Republic of Ireland and independence from Britain. This is News. Thanks for joining us. People have taken to the streets in London in solidarity with Palestinians. The pro-Palestine rally in central London comes one day before the 74th anniversary of the creation of the Israeli regime in 1948, called Nakba Day. The demonstrators chanted slogans decrying Israeli crimes and calling for an end to the regime's oppression against Palestinians. They also condemned the recent killing of Al Jazeera journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, demanding that perpetrators be brought to justice. The UN Security Council has condemned the killing of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. The 15-member UN body issued a unanimous condemnation on Friday. The Security Council called for an immediate, thorough, transparent, and impartial investigation into Abu Akleh's killing. She was a journalist at the Arabic language channel of the Qatar-based Al Jazeera TV network. Abu Akleh, 51 years old, was fatally shot while covering an Israeli army raid in the city of Jenin on Wednesday. She was wearing a press vest and standing with other journalists when targeted. The killing sparked an international outcry, with calls growing for Israel to be held accountable for the murder of the veteran reporter.
On Wednesday, two journalists covering an Israeli raid on the occupied West Bank city of Jenin for Qatari broadcaster Al Jazeera came under attack. Ali Al Samoudi was shot in the back but survived. His colleague, Shireen Abu Akleh, however, wasn't as lucky. The reporter was shot in the head and was pronounced dead after being rushed to the hospital. The attack came despite them both wearing vests with the word press emblazoned on them.
It wants the image of absolute lawlessness and operating with impunity. What could be more criminal than the targeted assassination? And just to say how strongly the whole world feels and the outrage at the assassination of Shireen Abu Akleh.
Also, according to eyewitnesses, the attack was unprovoked as there was no confrontation between Palestinians and the regime's forces at the time of the assault on the journalists.
The occupation is murderous and criminal. They shot us for no reason. We, a group of journalists, were there wearing our full press uniform in addition to the helmets with the word press written in large letters, as big as the whole world. We were obvious. We made sure to walk right in front of the army patrols so that they can see us, and they saw us after we went to a road where there were no armed people, no civilians, and there were no shooting and no incidents there. We were shocked by the shooting. I was lucky and I turned my back when the first bullet was shot and injured my back. They wanted to kill me. I was injured in my back and the second bullet shot my colleague Shireen and caused her death.
But the regime didn't spare Abu Akleh, even at her funeral. Israeli troops attacked mourners carrying the slain journalist's casket outside the hospital, causing the coffin to almost fall to the ground. She was later laid to rest in a cemetery in occupied East Al-Quds.
The United Nations and the European Union, along with several countries across the world, have denounced Abu Akleh's killing. The International Federation of Journalists and the Palestinian Authority have both vowed to submit the slain journalist's case to the International Criminal Court. But will mere denunciation deter Israel from continuing its crimes against Palestinians?
The journalist's killing and the subsequent attack during her funeral were met with international condemnation, with Israel's closest ally, the United States, calling it, quote, deeply concerning. The United Nations human rights experts have called the incident a serious attack on the freedom of media and expression and called for a transparent investigation. The case of the journalist set to be brought to the International Criminal Court, a tribunal that has in the past attempted to probe Israel's rights violations and war crimes against Palestinians, but failed to do so due to political pressure and sanctions from the United States. Israel's aggression against countries like Syria and Lebanon has also been protested in the international arena, but so far, the reactions from the international community have been limited to verbal support. That begs the question, will Tel Aviv face any accountability for its crimes?
Within international courts, because who controls international courts? And who controls the International Criminal Court while they're not even a signer to it? That's U.S. imperialism. So I don't think Israel will be brought to any kind of justice or accountability through this. But I think it's up to the people of the world, it's up to all honest reporters, journalists, and news services to make sure that this does not go unmarked.
Some observers also ascribe the intensified Israeli pressure on Palestinians to some Arab states' moves to normalize ties with the regime. The Arab states had claimed that their decisions would help the Palestinian cause, an excuse that has repeatedly proven to be nothing more than mere window dressing over the past 2 years. Many Palestinians believe that in the absence of any international accountability, resistance remains their only way forward.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. The Finnish Prime Minister Sanna Marin says the war in Ukraine and Russia's threat make it necessary for Helsinki to join NATO.
Well, we are in the situation in Europe where Russia acts very aggressive to its neighbors. We are having a war in Ukraine, so I think we are already there. And now we have to make sure that something that is happening in Ukraine right now won't ever again happen in Finland.
The remarks came after Finnish President Sauli Niinistö held talks with his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin over his country's bid to join the military alliance. Putin said that there is no threat to Finland's security, so should not abandon its neutrality policy. The Russian president believes joining NATO will have a negative impact on Moscow-Helsinki relations. Meanwhile, the Kremlin has warned that it will take adequate precautionary measures if NATO deploys nuclear forces and infrastructure closer to Russia's border. Gave assurances that Moscow has no hostile intentions toward Finland and Sweden. Helsinki is expected to announce its NATO membership bid on Sunday, and Sweden will likely follow suit. Johnny Miller is a correspondent joining us from Donbass to give us the latest, and Fred Weir is a journalist and political commentator joining us from Moscow for an analytical breakdown on this. So, Johnny Miller, at this point, given the fact that you are where you are at, tell us more about what you're seeing there and how things are looking in terms of the way that this war is going, and in particular in that area. What's happening there?
Well, there's been almost constant rumbling outgoing artillery from the outskirts of Donetsk. The major bulk of the Ukrainian army is situated in Donbass, and the current objective of the Russian military is to neutralize that bulk of the Ukrainian army. They're trying to effectively envelop that part of the army and so to take the rest of the Donbass and Luhansk. Ukraine is currently celebrating what it thinks is a victory of the Battle of Kharkiv, in which Russian soldiers have retreated, and it's unclear whether that's a strategic withdrawal from Russia or if it is indeed a victory for the Ukrainian army.
Fred Weir, one of the things that is making the news now, which we just covered, is the fact that you have Finland wanting to join NATO, including Sweden. And, of course, Russia says that that's unfortunate that they are doing that. But they are saying that Russia is posing a threat. Russia says it's not. Does Russia pose a threat to either?
I don't think so, but the geopolitics in play right now are getting quite intense. And you can understand, I think, the Finnish attitude. It has changed a lot as attitudes in the West and in Europe have changed toward Russia. It's sympathy for Ukraine and a failure, I guess, to see the Russian point of view, which your other guest was expressing, that the Russians say they are fighting for Donbass. Everyone else in the West particularly says they're invading Ukraine and infringing on its sovereignty. So this is an irreversible situation. I don't know to what extent the situation in Europe will actually change. I do not believe that Russia has designs on any NATO members of Europe, but Finland will add another 1,000-kilometer confrontation line between NATO and Russia, and things will heat up inevitably. It's just all really, really bad.
Okay, thank you very much for that. We'll leave it there. Let me thank Johnny Miller, correspondent from Donbass, reporting from Donbass, and Fred Weir, thank you, journalist and political commentator from Moscow. And with that, we come to an end for this news review. In Northern Ireland, a member of the Nationalist Party, Sinn Féin, says that the country is walking an irreversible journey towards reunification with the Republic of Ireland and independence from Britain.
I think there is an irreversible journey towards a united Ireland and the end of partition. Sinn Féin is at the very front of that movement to bring about an end of partition. The election results showed that Sinn Féin is the single biggest party in the north. Opinion polls over the last couple of years have shown that Sinn Féin is the biggest party in the south, and that there is a desire in the south in particular for the reunification of the country. What we want to happen is for the Dublin government to set up a citizens' assembly that can discuss all the issues around unification.
Pat Sheehan, who won a seat for Sinn Féin in the Western Belfast region, told Press TV that their victory was significant, as Republicans and other non-unionist parties were never expected to get top political jobs in the country. Sinn Féin secured 30% of the seats in the 90-seat legislature, ending a chain of victories for the pro-UK unionist parties. Those parties have been the largest in government since Northern Ireland was formed in 1921. Sheehan says their victory has its roots partly in the economy, as people are concerned over a cost of living crisis, with prices for fuel, food, and housing rising fast. He believes that most of these economic problems are connected to the Brexit referendum, which led to Britain getting out of the European Union. He says that Sinn Féin will plan for reunification with the European Union, and he has no doubt that this will happen.
But I think it will happen relatively soon. No one was predicting a year before the fall of apartheid that it was going to happen. Nobody was predicting the fall of the Berlin Wall a year before it happened. So people may think we're moving slowly, but at some stage that progress is going to accelerate, and I've no doubt we will see a united Ireland here.
He predicts that a referendum will take place this decade. Sheehan says they don't prefer a referendum similar to what happened in Brexit, where people did not know what they were voting for. They want all the facts on the table before a referendum takes place. The recent local polls in the UK also showed the ruling Conservative Party losing big in England. Pro-independence sentiments also remain strong in Scotland, where the Scottish National Party again finished as the biggest winner in council elections.
And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight. In Britain, almost two-thirds of tenants over the age of 65 have cut back on their general spending as a result of the cost of living crisis, and campaigners are warning that older people who do not own their homes are particularly vulnerable to rising fuel bills. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Hilary Osborne. The piece is titled, Older UK Renters Forced to Cut Back on Spending as Living Costs Soar. In Britain, almost two-thirds of tenants over the age of 65 have cut back on their general spending as a result of the cost of living crisis, and campaigners are warning that older people who do not own their homes are particularly vulnerable to to rising electricity and fuel bills. Research shared with Guardian Money by the charity Independent Age puts the spotlight on the struggles of older tenants who are battling to keep up with rising household costs. Its survey found that 62% of renters over the age of 65 were having to cut back on their general spending, and that they were more likely to be doing so than their contemporaries who were homeowners. A quarter said they would not be able to afford a £10 a month increase in their living costs, while 71% said they would not be able to cover a £50 rise. More than half said they felt anxious about their finances. The state's pension increased by 3.1% last month, well below the 7% inflation rate recorded in March. Energy bills went up at the same time, and with a further increase likely this October, economists have predicted inflation could go above 10% before the end of the year. Older private renters are particularly vulnerable to soaring inflation, particularly where rents have been rising too, says Dan Wilson-Craw, the deputy director of the campaign group Generation Rent. Unlike homeowners who are likely to have paid off their mortgage, they still have housing costs. If landlords want to raise the rent to reflect the wider market, there is little current tenants can do. For retirees on fixed incomes, this cuts their disposable income or forces them to move. Independent Age's survey of 2,000 adults in England over the age of 65, of whom 391 were renting, found that 57% of tenants were cutting back on heating. 42% said they had reduced how much food and drink they were buying. And 29% were buying less vehicle fuel. Aside from those most essential purchases, 46% said that they had cut back on clothing and on footwear purchase, and 39% had reduced their social activities. Separate figures from Shelter show that between the financial years of 2020-2021 and 2021-2022, there was a 20% increase in the number of over 65s contacting its helpline who were at risk of homelessness. Francisca, a 64-year-old, and her husband Colin, a 70-year-old, say their rent has risen by more than 7% this year. They are struggling to cover it and the other bills they face, despite making cutbacks. "When we go to the supermarket, we are buying the cheapest of the cheap," she says. "We're taking fewer baths, fewer showers. We turn the lights off, even on cold days. We turn the heating off." Although the couple chose to rent because, says Francisca, "we're not sure what the future holds," she says it has left them vulnerable. They have lived in poor housing in the past while paying a high rent. "We're evicted through a Section 21 no-fault eviction by one previous landlord, and have also had problems with letting agencies. This has made them very nervous about what happens when their contract ends next March." Their age has financial implications. "At our stage of life, we have a pot of money, and if we live a long life, we have to stretch it over that time," she says. "We can't go to work 9 to 5 or get new careers, so we rely on freelancing." Morgan Vine, the Independent Age head of policy, says older renters are left in increasingly precarious financial situations and need help and protection from the government. "Our research found that older renters are one of the most at-risk groups of dropping into poverty past state pension age and are more likely to experience long-term poverty," she says. "Day to day, we also know older renters are at an increased risk of living in poor quality homes and face higher costs and greater financial insecurity than other groups as a result." Morgan Vine says older renters have shared concerns with the charity about high rents and that their landlords could sell up at any time. "With the cost of living crisis squeezing people's budgets from every angle, these worries are only going to get worse," she says. Renters make up the minority of households in England with a head aged 65 or over, according to the latest official figures. The latest data shows there are 5.5 million owner-occupiers in this age range and 5.1 million own their home outright, which means no monthly mortgage costs. There are only 382,000 households in the private sector headed by an older person and 1 million in the social rented sector. Housing associations are allowed to put up rents by 4.1% in April, and many tenants who rent from them have seen increases. In the private rented sector, it is not easy to see what is happening to existing tenancies, but newly advertised contracts are typically costing more than a year ago. Polly Neat, the chief executive of Shelter, says older tenants are likely to be on low incomes, which would mean pressure from rising costs. With bills skyrocketing and private rents the highest on record, it's no wonder our emergency helpline is picking up the phone to older renters who, instead of preparing for retirement, are facing homelessness. No one should be forced to choose between eating or paying their rent, she says. Wilson Crawl says the state pension has risen by less than inflation, but it's worse for private renters relying on housing benefit, which has been frozen since 2020. If these people are paying higher rents, that money could be coming out of the rest of their income, and that's before we even think about rising energy prices. Wilson Crow adds, we need a freeze on rents and another suspension of evictions to protect tenants during this crisis.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
The British government has been accused of trading people like commodities after Prime Minister Boris Johnson announced last month that the migrants and asylum seekers illegally entering Britain will be sent thousands of miles away to Rwanda as part of a deal with the African country.
From today, our new migration and economic development partnership will mean that anyone entering the UK illegally, as well as those who have arrived illegally since January the 1st, may now be relocated to Rwanda.
Welcome, and this is Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. This week, we are focusing on Britain's controversial plans to deport asylum seekers to Rwanda. Now, human rights activists are saying that this deal is cruel, immoral, neo-colonial, likely unlawful, and a threat to the lives of refugees. So what are the real reasons behind this deal, and is London imitating a similar arrangement that the Israeli regime had with Rwanda? Is this agreement part of a plan by Boris Johnson to divert attention from the embarrassment of his Partygate scandal? These are some of the questions which I'll be asking our experts today.
Inhuman UK-Rwanda Refugee Pact. The United Kingdom is under harsh criticism over its plan to send illegal immigrants and asylum seekers thousands of miles away to Rwanda. Last month, Britain announced a deal with Rwanda to send asylum seekers to the East African country, claiming the measure would stop people smugglers sending desperate migrants on treacherous journeys across the English Channel. Prime Minister Boris Johnson claims that Rwanda will have the capacity to resettle tens of thousands of people in the years ahead.
The UK has promised Rwanda an initial £120 million as part of what has been termed as an economic transformation and integration program. Now, this payment has been equated to a slave trade agreement. Rwandan opposition leader Frank Habineza has slammed Britain's decision to send refugees to his country, terming it as inhumane and a violation of human rights.
We are competing against these kind of deals, whether it's Denmark or UK or Israel or whatever. We are not in agreement. If people come to you, take care of them. We have signed the UN Convention, all of us, to take care of refugees. It's really inhumane and also against human rights. Because if it's the right of the people to go where they have gone, so if you send them to a country where they did not choose, that means you're forcing them to go somewhere else. So that's against their rights. It's an abuse of human rights as well. So we have to respect their rights and the rights of refugees.
For more on this controversial Rwanda-UK refugee deal, we contacted Claude Gatebuke, the executive director of the Africa Great Lakes Action Network. Thanks a lot, sir, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We also have with us today Julius Mbaluto, an African affairs analyst, who will also briefly contribute to our conversation. Welcome again to our program, Mr. Mbaluto.
My pleasure.
Now, human rights groups and refugee organizations have called Britain's plan to send refugees to Rwanda as cruel, inhumane, and neocolonial. Mr. Gatebuke, do you agree with this description?
Absolutely. The only thing I would add is a few other things. It's not only cruel, inhumane, and neo-colonialist, it's also human trafficking. It is the trade of humans in selling people to, you know, trading people for money. It's similar to the slave trade. It's basically modern-day slave trade. And by the way, this is just a legalized way of trafficking human beings. So that would be my my one additional remark to that. So calling it cruel, inhumane, and neocolonial is true. It also, there is just a stench of white supremacy where you think people that you do not desire or individuals that you do not desire, that you could just take them and dump them, basically throw them away and just pay the money to throw them away and send them to an African country.
Rwanda is a country that has experienced deadly ethnic and political tensions and produces many refugees itself. This tiny and densely populated country suffered a devastating genocide in 1994, where more than 800,000 mostly ethnic Tutsis were massacred. Opposition leader Frank Habineza warns that the influx of new refugees could be dangerous for the country.
Conflicts are inevitable. When people come in and you say you're going to give them those £120 million and they are going to live a very good life, whereas other Rwandans, they don't have anything the same way as that, then be sure that there will be conflicts that people will say, oh, so these people are living a better life than us. Yeah, so there'll be conflicts. Then there'll also be conflicts on natural resources, competition. We don't have land, and if the Americans are going to settle here, that means we'll be given land. They'll be also have given other, put into the national budget like others, because that money is only for 5 years. Afterwards, we don't know what happens.
Why did Britain decide to select Rwanda, one of the most densely populated countries in the world and one of the tiniest countries in Africa?
There's not even the space for the people there, but Britain and Rwanda both have a lot to gain from each other. Rwanda will gain PR, which it's badly in need of because of the way they treat their abysmal and horrible human rights record. And the British get to play the card that will please Prime Minister Boris Johnson's constituents. I'm not sure that they all even like that idea. I think they just thought if we dump immigrants and turn the issue to the immigrants, everything will be fine. Everything is about money. You know, Britain is going to gain, politically, especially the party in power, and Rwanda's going to gain money. But the people who are being dumped to Rwanda are going to suffer like other refugees who have been sent, who have sought refuge in Rwanda.
The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, also voiced opposition to the UK-Rwanda refugee deal. Assistant High Commissioner for Protection, Gillian Trigg, says people fleeing war, conflict, and persecution deserve compassion and empathy. They should not be treated like commodities and transferred abroad for processing.
Trigg described the Rwanda-US deal as shifting asylum responsibilities and evading international obligations that are contrary to the letter and spirit of the Refugee Convention. Now, let's bring in Mr. Mbaluto. What's your take on Britain's decision to literally dump refugees into Rwanda?
When you look into the UK, their position is like they want to exploit freedoms that came because of Brexit. But if you know what was the driving force with the Brexit, was extreme racism, and it was really not really such a great thing. In UK leaving Europe was not driven because of good reasons, but more than, you know, wanting to be independent, make decisions, not be controlled by European Court of Law, which was all the time reinforcing human rights when they were being violated within the UK territory.
Well, now, despite some positive economic indicators, Rwanda is still among the world's 25 poorest countries. Now, Britain's use of cash to entice Rwanda to accept the deal is considered as some form of exploitation.
Britain claims to be a champion of human rights, but it breaches its international commitments and responsibilities by sending refugees to Rwanda.
If you'd only listen to the claims by these nations, you know, claiming to be, to respect human rights, you might believe it. But when you look at some of the practices in Britain, when it comes to immigrants and refugees, I mean, in recent years there were refugee and immigrant protest, you know, showing that, you know, their rights were not highly respected. But if you look at human rights, you can't just confine yourself to inside of the country and to claim the person, the country that simply claims to be a champion for human rights.
Britain's opposition leader has also slammed the government's plan to send illegal immigrants to Rwanda to have their claims processed. Let's listen in.
I think we need to see these plans for what they are. It's a desperate announcement by a Prime Minister who just wants to distract from his own law-breaking. You know, they're unworkable, they're extortionate, they're going to cost taxpayers billions of pounds, and they just reflect a Prime Minister who's got no grit, no answers to the questions that need answering, and no shame. And I just think Britain deserves better than this. I think it's a desperate announcement. The true aim of this is just to distract from the law-breaking of the Prime Minister. And that's why I say it shows that he's got no answers, he's got no grip, he's got no shame. It's a desperate announcement, unworkable, extortionate, and Britain really does deserve better than this.
Boris Johnson's Rwanda migrant announcement has been termed as an attempt to divert attention from the Partygate scandal. What's your take on this, Mr. Mbaluto?
When you look into all these scandals surrounding the Prime Minister and all the criticism, you know, all the attention that drew, you may wonder whether it was a move to kill bad news. Bad news, I'm talking about the scandals, the Partygate scandal, COVID, handling of the COVID, and everything that was all around it. Of course, we see still ongoing, but he refused to resign. He apologized. He was fined by the police only £50.
Okay, we thank Mr. Mbaluto for his insight, and we now take a short break. When we come back, we shall continue with our discussion on the controversial plan by Britain to forcefully send asylum seekers to Rwanda. So stay with us.
Inhuman UK-Rwanda Refugee Pact.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back to this week's edition of Africa Today, which is focusing on an inhumane Rwanda-UK deal on refugees. Now, the Israeli regime also struck secret deals in 2013 with Rwanda and Uganda to transfer asylum seekers from Sudan and Eritrea. Rwanda's last migrant deal with the Israeli regime ended in disaster. Now, can you elaborate on the fate of the refugees dumped by the Israeli regime into Rwanda?
There are the Eritreans and the Sudanese refugees who were part of a deal with Israel. And I know we may be talking about this a little bit later, but I wanna, you know, just put it all together. There's a group of refugees from Israel. They were Eritrean and Sudanese. There was a plan to send to Rwanda 4,000 refugees, $5,000 a head. So they were selling them, basically. You know, Rwanda was doing the trade with Israel to trade the refugees. Rwanda was going to make $20 million off of the deal. They started with a pilot. The initial refugees, the Eritrean refugees that they sent to Rwanda, were distorted of their money by Rwandan officials who were supposed to resettle them in Rwanda. They took their money. They put them in horrible living conditions. They raped the women. And they impregnated children. Some of those refugees were dumped at the border of Uganda after they took away all their papers and everything. Those refugees ended up in Libya in slavery. And some of them have made their way all the way back to Europe. So it hasn't worked even previously when it was done. That deal ended up falling apart.
The then Prime Minister of the Israeli regime, Benjamin Netanyahu, pursued the inhumane deal to forcefully deport African refugees in an attempt to please his supporters in Israel. To capitalize on the xenophobia and anti-African sentiments he has encouraged when he came to power in 2009. Is Boris Johnson taking cue from Netanyahu by sending refugees to Rwanda to deflect attention from the Partygate scandal?
It's always the easy escape when it comes, as I said before, to white supremacy. White supremacy basically looks at black and brown people, non-white people, as objects. And the Boris Johnson government facing Partygate found the objects that they could basically dump, where they could deflect the attention. And the deflection of attention went to the immigrants and the black and brown people, basically, for the most part. So it's similar game. It's a similar play. It's same playbook when it comes to when these Western leaders are in trouble, they turn to racism, xenophobia, and white supremacy. And that is what happened with the Boris Johnson government trying to deal with Partygate.
The controversial arrangement between Rwanda and the Israeli regime on the deportation of asylum seekers failed when the refugees who had their documents taken away and were offered no protection escaped Rwanda to embark on a dangerous journey to Europe. An African immigrant in the occupied territories voiced his opposition to the deportation deals.
מאוד קשה, מאוד גרוע. אנחנו שכר בן אדם. איך יכול להיות? אני לא מיוגנדה, אני לא מרואנדה. איך יכול להיות ראש הממשלה מחליט אנשים לשחר אותם למדינות אחרים? ובלי בלי שום אישור, בלי מסמכים, בלי שום דבר. איך אפשר למכור אותנו כאילו אנחנו עבדים? מה אנחנו? איך? איך זה יכול להיות? אחרי 10 שנים.
Will Rwanda's refugee deal with Britain suffer the same fate that befell a similar pact with the Israeli regime that collapsed?
It's possible that the deal will see a similar fate because there is a lot of resistance, but it's really going to depend on how much the British taxpayers and the British public and parliament gets in, you know, gets involved, because that is how the and also the organization, the pressure from around the world to stop the deal. Because even the deal in Israel, which was not as highly publicized as this one, was highly resisted. There were many organizations, human rights organizations around the world, including our own, that were a part of resisting that deal. And so I think it's going to depend on the pressure. For the most part, really, pressure is what's going to make it work. But then also the response by the British public to the deal. Right now, it looks like it may fall apart, but you never know.
The UK-Rwanda refugees deal has several precedents. European powers have been targeting Africa for similar agreements since migration pressures increased in 2015. Many African countries and the African Union have rejected such agreements.
In 2021, the African Union slammed reports of a law passed by the parliament in Denmark to relocate asylum seekers to countries outside the European Union while their cases are being processed. The African Union termed such a move as xenophobic and completely unacceptable.
Rwanda agreed to take in immigrants denied entry into the United Kingdom, even as Kenya declined London's requests to help it ease the burden of unwanted guests. Kenya, which already hosts over 800,000 refugees, most in camps and others in urban centers across the country, reportedly declined Britain's offer to take in the migrants.
According to reports, before making the partnership deal with Rwanda, the UK had approached other countries in the region, including Kenya, which declined the request on a cost-benefit analysis. A Kenyan political analyst, Mustafa Ali, says Western colonial powers are, in fact, the root cause of the current refugee crisis. Let's take a listen.
Upstream and check what is the problem upstream. And this is what Britain should have done. They should be checking the first world, the so-called first world, the international community. Why is it that these many young people are leaving Africa to want to go to Europe? Obviously, there are challenges in Africa. And of course, it starts with our leadership, our leaders, to try and address some of those challenges. There are challenges that are beyond our leaders that are actually caused by just the unjust international system, international community. And the West, particularly Britain, cannot escape blaming this. The colonialism and the kind of subjugation that some of the European countries put Africa to during colonial times, still a big cause of poverty in Africa.
Now, why did Britain approach Kenya first, and what prompted the authorities in Nairobi to reject the plan?
The fact that they declined, I'm not sure why, but I know one thing. Many countries have refused to accept deportees, people who are deported from Western countries. In fact, in places, especially in the Caribbean, for example, places like Jamaica and Trinidad and many other places, a lot of the deportees have become the biggest criminals, violent criminals in those countries. So many countries have refused to accept basically deportees. And what is happening with the British deal with Rwanda is basically a forced deportation without due process to a place that's not even home. That is what's happening. And so those may be the reasons why Kenyan authorities refused, but I'm not 100% sure. But I know based on what's happened in other places, those may be the reasons.
Rwandan President Paul Kagame now says the UK approached him over the sending of refugees to his country, as he had helped refugees during his time as African Union chairperson. He also rejected accusations that his deal with Britain was tantamount to slave trade.
This is why I was saying there are things you can't buy about us. Yes. We are who we are, and we are proud people too. We are not involved in buying and selling of people, Rwanda and the UK, anybody. No, it's just a problem that people will have different views about it. They look at it differently. You know what happened about it. That's okay. People will have looked at, but at the end of the day, you've got to do something.
The president of Rwanda has defended the deal, claiming it was not about trading people, but it will offer a chance to asylum seekers to begin a new life. Now, what's your take on this, Mr. Getabuke?
At the end of the day, it's all about the money and PR that Kagame, Paul Kagame is who I'm referring to, is going to make off of the people. The government under Kagame, the Rwandan regime under Kagame, under the RPF, is going to make off of the people. That's what it's about. It's about getting money, getting resources, because it is a poor country, and it's also about public relations, you know, having this image of, you know, we are giving human beings a place to begin a new life when even the people there are actually wanting to leave. Last point, Rwanda has one of the highest refugee population on the African continent. It's not only the most highly densely populated country, but it has one of the largest numbers of people who have left the country and to this day are unwilling to return. So Rwanda can't even give a new life and hope to Rwandans who have fled the regime. But they're claiming that they can provide it to the people that Britain wants to trade with them in this human trafficking deal to resettle them and give them a chance at new life. That is a big, bold-faced lie.
Well, I'd like to thank Mr. Claude Getabuke for his incisive analysis. There you have it. The United Kingdom is basically engaged in a human trafficking deal with Rwanda. Let us know what you think about this controversial deal. Well, that's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. It's been great having you. You can send us your comments through our social media handle, and goodbye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.